Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services from Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services. My podcast co-host and editor, Josh Berezin, is off taking care of a new baby. Congratulations, Josh. She's very cute. So you just have me today. I hope that Josh will be back next month. Fortunately, we have two wonderful co-authors to interview. First is Leopoldo J. Cabasa, PhD. He's an associate professor and director of the NIMH T32 Brown School Training Program in Mental Health Services Research. And he's also the co-director of the Center for Mental Health Services Research Group at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis. Hi, Leo. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, Lisa.
Dr. Cabasa is joined by Dr. Anna Stefanchik, PhD. Dr. Stefanchik is an associate research scientist at Columbia University. Welcome, Anna.
Hello, everyone.
Doctors Cabasa and Stefanchik were lead authors on an article in Psych Services this past month called Main Outcomes of a Peer-Led Healthy Lifestyle Intervention for People with Serious Mental Illness in Supportive Housing. And this is a really important article in so many ways. And so I'm really looking forward to talking with Leo and Anna about this. So we always start our podcast with a little bit of background interest in our authors. How did each of you get into this field of work, this line of research? What interested you about it? What's your background?
So I'll start. And Lisa, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about our work. Anna and I are super excited to be here. From my end, I'm a social worker, as you know, and I started this work actually when I first got to New York after being at the University of Southern California in the School of Social Work. I went to the New York State Psychiatric Institute to work at the Center for Cultural Competence, the Center of Excellence for Cultural Competence that at that time was being created. And this work actually started with one of the first studies that that center did, which is a big qualitative study in Northern Manhattan to examine the physical health needs and healthcare needs of people with serious, that had serious mental illness and also were raised from racial and ethnic minority groups. Mm. And so we really wanted to understand sort of the needs, what were some of the barriers that people were facing, what were some of the agencies that were working and dedicating services to this population. And we learned a lot. We interview almost every single stakeholder you can think of, from family members and clients to clinicians, administrators, community leaders, around this topic about what were the physical health needs, what can we do about it, what type of services people will want, what were some of the programs that these agencies were creating. And we went to outpatient mental health clinics, supportive housing agencies, hospitals, community centers. And it really gave us a really interesting view of the need and what could be possible. And that's actually how I met Anna in many ways, doing some interviews with one of the supportive housing that participated in this work. So it started from that view of a real formative needs assessment from the ground up, and then getting into this literature around the physical health needs of people with serious mental illness. And at that time, we identified a huge gap around sort of the racial and ethnic minority groups, their needs for this type of services, their need for healthcare interventions, and the comorbidities that people were living with, and how what could be possible? What type of interventions would be possible for this group? So that's how we started this journey, and from there began to think about intervention work and other things, and there's different lines of work that we've developed from there.
So. How about you, Anna?
So on a personal level, I got involved with this type of work as a college student when I was a psychology college student doing an internship. And I was doing a research interview with someone who had schizophrenia, and I'd never, ever had contact with individuals who were really part of the SMI population before. And I remember in this middle of this research interview, this really young guy, he just he pulls out a yo-yo and starts just playing with the yo-yo. And he's clearly bored out of his mind with this interview. And, you know, again, and I, you know, I had no idea what to be expecting having not done any of this work before. And, you know, in that moment, it was just so transformative. It was just so endearing. And, you know, I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to stop this interview and, you know, and get to know this person on an entirely, you know, different level. And it just sort of changed my whole perspective on the work, you know, the work with individuals with serious mental illness. And so I, you know, continued on for a
little time. What a great story. Yo-yo story. You know, last month I interviewed someone who's a dentist, and I said, well, never had a dentist before on this podcast. And I would have to say now that we have never heard mention of a yo-yo, okay, on this podcast. So thank you, Anna, for introducing that dimension into this work. Okay, well, great. So I think just to get started, it would be good to get everybody on the same page and just do a quick review of this study and the findings that you reported.
Sure. So this is part of a five-year program grant that we have from the National Institute of Mental Health. This is the design of the study. It's what we call a hybrid type one design, where we are the main hypothesis and the main aim is to test the effectiveness of our intervention. In this case, this intervention was a peer-led group lifestyle balance intervention. It's a 12-month manualized intervention that focuses on helping people improve their physical activity and improve their dietary habits. And it's being delivered by peer specialists, people with lived experiences with serious mental illness who are we have trained, we have worked with them. And this project is all being done in supportive housing agencies in two cities. We basically recruited 314 participants. We randomly assigned them to either receive this group lifestyle intervention versus usual care. And then we did assessment at baseline, 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months post-randomization. And in this paper, we're focusing on our main outcomes, which is basically clinical, the proportion of people who achieve clinically significant weight change. That's a change of 5% weight loss from baseline at each of our assessment periods. And then we also examine cardiorespiratory fitness through the 6-minute walking test and a combination of these two measures of whether you have achieved clinical significant weight loss or clinically significantly improved in cardiorespiratory fitness, meaning that you've increased 50 meters of walking every time we did the 6-minute walking test in each of our assessment periods. And then a combination of those two things, which we call sort of reduction, clinical significant reduction in cardiovascular disease risk.
Underline something for our listeners. Sure. These outcomes, I imagine, are the sort of the typical, usual, important outcomes in these kind of studies. Is that right? The sort of the standard.
That's exactly
outcomes.
Right. And, mm-hmm. That's right. And for this particular R01 from the National Institute of Mental Health, in this call for proposals, they wanted this type of outcome. That was one of the specific elements of mm-hmm. this portfolio of research to really empower the different trials that they were funding with this clinical significant changes in a health outcome. So in our case was weight and cardiorespiratory fitness.
Great.
And I also one important component, a unique characteristic of this study was that we were focusing on recruiting a majority of participants from racial and ethnic minority groups. So we from the very beginning, we want to make sure that we had a large representation of racial and ethnic minorities in the trial. That was one of the main sort of impetus of this work. And then delivering this in a non-clinical setting like supportive housing agencies, bringing these interventions to people's doorsteps. It was a major impetus for this story. So that's sort of the
Can I just ask you to just to sort of talk a little bit about that, and either you or Anna, that the study was done in housing programs, right? Not in the clinic. And to me, that is a really, really important dimension for our listeners to understand. So it would be nice if we could just hear a little bit about these programs and what were the requirements and, how was it for you to go into these programs and provide a service?
So, you know, just to be really explicit, so the supportive housing agencies that we were working with all provided, you know, some form of community-based housing, and then a various kind of range of support services along with that. And the reason why we wanted to focus on supportive housing in particular is because much of the sort of the residents that live in supportive housing, they encounter numerous barriers to being able to access services elsewhere. So you can't take for granted that people are going to be going to a clinic and, you know, show up at, you know, for a 2 o'clock appointment and, you know, receive a service. And so we really wanted to make sure that we just, you know, completely eliminated as many barriers as possible so that people could actually participate in our, you know, in our study and in the intervention. So as Leo has said many times, it was literally trying to bring the, you know, bring this intervention to people's doorsteps. So, you know, we're not asking you to come anywhere, you know, we will come to you. And we really wanted to engage a population that, you know, for the most part, studies have not really been recruiting from, and just make sure that we could expand the reach of these types of interventions.
So are these housing units scatter site or are they congregate?
That's a great question. So because we worked with three different sites, there was actually a mix of housing types. So at one site, it was primarily, it was scatter site housing with modified assertive community treatment teams. At another site, it was a full range of housing. So, you know, everything from an independent scatter site apartment to a community residence type of arrangement. And then, you know, a spectrum of supports in between. So there was a big variety in terms of the sites themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So, okay. So I interrupted you, Leo, and now I'll go back to you.
For sure. So we want to sort of clarify that the idea for also another important element of why we went to supportive housing is because we had in the formative research, we had done a photo voice project with in two housing agencies in New York around physical health and wellness. And photo voice is a participatory research method that provides people with cameras. They go out into the community, they take pictures of their everyday life, and then they come together and discuss them and really talk about what they're seeing, the stories behind those pictures. And we had done that project to really get a sense of what could be possible in supportive housing. What would clients really want? What do they want out of a health intervention? And many of the key elements of this trial, the seeds for the trial were planted during that project of that photo voice project. Mm. The idea that people wanted a peer. They didn't want a professional to tell them what to do. They wanted someone who have walked the walk, who have lived experiences with the challenges of serious mental illness and health issues in the communities that people are living. So that was very powerful to learn. They wanted an intervention that focused on diet and exercise, but in their community. How do you do this living in the communities that people are living, being very specific about how to not only tell them what to do, but how to do that in their everyday lives, and that bring that intervention to supportive housing seemed something very acceptable for them. So the idea for why we wanted to work and partner with the settings and do a peer-led intervention came from that data. Mm-hmm. And then we continue to push that forward.
It might be helpful also just to give a little bit of a description of what the peer-led program was. So it's very intensive and led by peers, but what do they do?
Yeah, so this program actually, it comes from the group Lifestyle Balance. So it's a manualized intervention. It's 22 sessions over the course of a year. The group Lifestyle Balance intervention is developed from the Diabetes Prevention Program. And the group Lifestyle Balance is a program that's been developed and trained and modified and done at the University of Pittsburgh. And we had great partners from the University of Pittsburgh in training us on this intervention. But the intervention really focuses on physical activity, increasing physical activity, increasing healthy dietary habits. It uses goal setting, self-monitoring, behavioral strategies to help the person set up weight loss goals, strategies on how to get to that goal, and move step by step. And it has three phases. It has a core 12-week with weekly sessions that run around 60 minutes. It's delivering in a group setting, so you're getting information, but you're also getting the group interaction and learning from each other. Then it has a transition phase where you meet every other week for 60 minutes, and then it goes into a maintenance session that is on a monthly basis for the last 6 months. So it's a long-term intervention. It's helping people really understand where they are with their weight, what changes do they need to make to their diet and their exercise, to this healthy balance where you want to increase your physical activity, but also work on your nutrition, eating more fresh fruits and vegetables, less fatty foods, and really help the person make these lifestyle changes. Mm-hmm. There's a large component of self-monitoring. So we're asking people to keep track of their diet, of their calories, of when they're eating, what they're eating, portion control. So it's a comprehensive, healthy lifestyle intervention that has been used and has proven effective for multiple populations and racial and ethnic minority groups throughout the United States. And it has shown good effects in weight loss and preventing diabetes and helping people that have diabetes to control their diabetes. So we're basing this on that evidence base that was already generated from that. And then we adapted it for a peer-led component as well as for people with serious mental illness and supportive housing.
That's mostly it. I don't know if this is a good opportunity to talk a little bit about the work of the peers and some of our focus on understanding how the peers actually approached supporting people in
sure.
the intervention.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that we really wanted to spend some time on was, in addition to understanding, was the intervention going to be effective in a number of ways, was to really try and understand how were the peers actually serving the participants, and what, how might their work be any different from the way that, someone else, a non-peer provider, might facilitate this type of intervention. And so, one of the things we found by talking to both participants and talking to both peer specialists with qualitative interviews was that people really emphasized that, the shared experience of mental illness was absolutely foundational to individuals being just preliminarily engaged in the intervention and being willing to come to, session number one and listen and come back. But then in addition to that, they emphasized how really throughout the intervention, it was the peer specialist's shared experience of other physical health challenges and their own struggles with weight issues that really resonated with participants. And so the peer specialists were absolutely delivering the intervention components, because we monitored that with fidelity. So we know that they were delivering aspects of the intervention as it was manualized, but they were also tapping into their own experience of, it was the holidays. I went overboard with the food over the holidays as well, but it's okay. Tomorrow's another day, and we'll both start again, kind of a thing. We're just talking about their own experience of, how devastating it is to sort of watch your weight change after, after psychiatric medication has been started, and just, to validate kind of how disheartening that can be and how challenging it can be to sort of like counteract that impact. And so the peer specialists just constantly were really offering individuals that sense of, validation of how challenging it is, but also just encouraging them to keep trying, and that tomorrow is always another day. And the participants really underscored how they just, they just constantly felt hopeful that they could continue trying to do this. And, they did not get discouraged and, kind of drop out just because, they weren't seeing a difference in their weight.
I think it would be important to describe usual care. What did people in usual care have access to?
Yeah, and I'm happy to do that, and I jump in as well. Usual care, basically, we did several things to examine usual care. One, we asked people, over the past 6 months, these are all self-report measures, are they going to their doctor? Have they been hospitalized for physical or mental health issue? Are they going to the ER? But we also, at the beginning of this trial, before we started, we actually went to each of the sites and developed an individual measure for each site to understand what type of health or wellness services these people were receiving at these clinics. So places had wellness groups that they'd gone to, cooking classes, they had walking groups. So for each site, we actually individualize and tailor a usual care service measure for each of the sites to really understand what was possible. Most of these were group-based. They were not standardized, or they were not manualized intervention. They were most about health education, teaching people how to eat better, providing information about health and health promotion. So those are the type of usual care services that each of the sites were delivering when we started the trial. Mm-hmm. And anything else from the usual care component as well?
No, I think I would just really add that, you know, this was also part of a larger push to integrate health and physical health into supportive housing, and just to underscore that. And so the agencies that we had been working with really had already begun to integrate various aspects of physical health within their services. So, you know, they may have been running their own, you know, clinic where individuals could actually access physical health services. What we were doing was trying to add another service that would expand on that by bringing the peer-led component and by bringing that manualized, intensive, year-long intervention component.
Thanks. I mean, there's so much to talk about with the method, and we will certainly get back to that, but I think we should talk just, you know, very briefly again, present the main outcomes.
Sure. So I'm happy to do that. So basically what we found was that overall, we basically have a null finding trial here, where in our main outcomes of clinical significant weight loss, clinical significant improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness, and clinical significant reduction in cardiovascular health risk reduction, we found no statistically significant differences between our peer-led intervention and our usual care site. And everyone's improving over time. That was one of the major things, but statistically, no statistical significance between the two groups. There was a larger proportion of people in PGLB who achieved these outcomes at the 12 and 18 months, but as I mentioned, no statistical significance between the two.
So I think we have to now try to reconcile the findings, right, and try to understand them. So Leo, you were talking about that there were no differences between the peer-led and the non-peer-led and usual care.
That's right. And what we found, I mean, overall, by 18 months, about 30 to 32% of people, 30% in the usual care and 32% of people in the peer-led, in the PGLB group, achieved clinical significant weight loss overall across the entire study. And we found in cardiorespiratory fitness, about 25% in usual care, 29% in the intervention at 18 months. And in terms of clinical significant reduction in cardiovascular risk, about 49% of people in both arms achieved that clinical significant reduction at 18 months. However, we also examined by site. We knew that these are very different sites. We knew that the experience of running this trial also showed us that each of these sites was a little bit different population, different settings, different ways in which they're integrating and addressing health issues of their clients. And when we examined that or stratify our findings by that, we found site differences. We found that site 1 and 2 tended to basically usual care and intervention group tended to have no statistical significant differences. In fact, usual care did a little bit better in most of our outcomes in sites 1 and 2. But in site 3, we found statistically significant differences between the PGLB and usual care, particularly in clinical significant weight loss in site 3 at 18 months and in reductions of cardiovascular disease risk at 6 and 12 months. So something, basically our finding indicating that this intervention seem to have worked differently at that site. And that was an important element of a hybrid type one design that we have also collected, apart from the effectiveness trial, different qualitative data at multiple levels of how we deliver this intervention, the experience of both participants, as Anna had mentioned, as well as a leader's experience and provider's experience of us being in that, in developing this partnership with his agency. So it gives us an opportunity to explore the context in which these interventions and this trial happen and what, how can we then explain the site differences? That's sort of where we're at this point with this work.
Do you have any theories as to why the sites were so different?
We have many theories, and we actually have a we're actually using a mixed method approach now of all the data that we've collected to begin to identify why one site did better than others. And there are many different things that are coming up. One is the context. I think the context of health integration at each of the sites was very different from each other. We have sites that during the span of our trial began to really integrate healthcare services within their sites. They even have a SAMHSA grant that happened during our trial where they began to embed primary care within their site and open up more healthcare services. So the way that health was being discussed and addressed shifted throughout our trial.
That's so unfortunate when you're doing a trial and you realize that something happens that to make the usual care condition much stronger in the middle of your study, huh? I mean, it's way better for the participants.
Exactly.
But yeah. So that's exactly. Something.
And you know, exactly. But in a real world type of trial of this nature, it's going to happen. I mean, the context is always shifting. And part of why these agencies actually participated in this trial is because they were interested in the health and improving the physical health of their clients. They wanted to do something, and they're doing something to improve the health. So I think that context and the interaction of our intervention and the context of practice where we're delivering this care is shifting. So that's an important element. I mean, our usual care improved over time. That's the other component that we see here. People in usual care are getting better over time as we're doing that. So one component is the context. The other component is something, the fidelity, as Anas mentioned. We're beginning to examine the fidelity of our delivery. You know, did we deliver intervention as intended? And we're starting to see some differences in the site that did better, having a little bit higher levels of fidelity. And Anna can talk a little bit more about sort of what some of the thoughts that we have around that element of fidelity. If you want to talk about that, Anna. No.
Yeah, I think as opposed to kind of going in depth into fidelity, I mean, yes, it was, you know, it was slightly high. Overall, it was high at all the sites, very high, but it was highest at site 3, which had the best outcomes in terms of the intervention. But at site 3, there was also a little bit more of an organizational culture of providing and offering group-based services. So because our intervention was group-based, and there was sort of this existing little bit more of an infrastructure supporting group-based services, there also participants were exposed to the intervention in group-based format at the highest rates. So for example, at site 1, there was actually much greater frequency of just having the intervention delivered one-on-one. So individuals didn't necessarily get access to perhaps that important kind of group interaction and group-based support. So that's just another potential factor.
You know, one thing I noticed when I read the paper and in the context of review is that you did patient-level randomization. So just for the audience, a lot of times when we're doing an intervention study, we'll do site level randomization. And one of the reasons, I'm curious whether you saw one of the problems with doing patient level randomization in this kind of a study, which is kind of bleed or across conditions, that the existence of the actual study and half of the participants getting the intervention can change the program. Because
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And one of the things that we did, and we were concerned about that too. We did that individual level randomization at the site due to, you know, constraints that we had for the study, and we only had 3 sites. But we tracked, starting at 6 months, we began to ask all participants in both arms whether they were doing things that were related to our intervention. Are you tracking your eating? Are you tracking your exercise? Are you weighing yourself regularly? Are you using a pedometer? Are you setting a weight loss goal? Are you setting an exercise goal? And overall, we found that the PGLB group, because these are all elements of our intervention, all critical pieces of our intervention, consistently the PGLB group is reporting engaging in those behaviors at a higher frequency at 6, 12, and 18 months. So that's the people who are in the intervention are doing it. But we're also also saw that people in usual care group started to do some of those activities and started to report some of those activities. And in some of those places, for example, tracking eating, which is not something you usually do. For example, at 18 months, 45% of people in the usual care group are saying that they're tracking their eating. Similarly, 45% of usual care group are saying that they're tracking their exercise. So something definitely, that was another hypothesis that we have. There was some social proliferation or contamination between the groups that could have happened here, that they talk to each other about what they're doing, that they're telling the people in PDLB, communicating this to their friends in their housing agency about what they're doing and things like that. So that's a really important element here to also examine. And it's also something about that people are engaging. You know, these are people enrolling a randomized controlled trial about weight loss. Even if they're not receiving our intervention, they might be already primed to start doing something about their physical health and engaging in some of these behaviors.
I was going to say, it makes me wonder if the peer component influenced the extent to which these practices penetrated the agency. In other words, would there have been the same kind of bleed, if you will, or engagement with some of these activities had the intervention not been a peer-delivered intervention? And obviously, we don't know the answer to that question, but there's a logic to it in my mind as I think about it.
It could be. We definitely, the peers, the role of the peers, they were employees at this agency. So the agency, these peers were being paid by the agency. They were part of the staff of the agency, but their dedicated time was to deliver this intervention, not to deliver usual care services or get involved in usual care services. But it is a possibility that there's some element. We also saw in the qualitative data that we have, particularly in the leadership interviews that we did, and this is with the directors of the agencies and the program managers that were managing health services or health and wellness programs within this agency. When we interviewed them before we started the trial and after we mm-hmm. finished the trial, and there's definitely a shift in how people are talking about health, paying more attention to clients' physical health issues, being more aware of the physical health problems that people are having, being more concerned about how to connect people to care. So something definitely shifted in terms of attention to health integration and doing things, services, an opportunity to help people with their physical health needs. And that was an interesting element of our hybrid design to really understand how this context may have shifted as we were involved in partnering with each of these agencies.
So we're gonna about out of time. And I wanted to just end with a couple of questions. One, I noticed in the text that you acknowledged Kaylee Adams.
Mm-hmm. And, Kaylee Adams.
Yes. And I wanted to ask you both to remember her if that's okay, and sort of talk about what her role was and what happened and how did the loss of her impact the project.
Sure. So Kelly was the very first peer specialist that we hired for this project. And she sort of not, you know, because she came on so early, she really was able to contribute in so many ways to the team and to sort of this building of team culture between, you know, the researchers and the peer specialists and the sites. And so, you know, she really worked with us to kind of further adapt the intervention in the early stages to make sure that it was actually going to be, going to be seen as relevant by the participants that we were going to be working with. She helped train other peers. So she was really such a vital, just like the heart and soul of the project, I think is how we often think of her. And unfortunately, she passed away several years into the project. And it was you know, very devastating for the entire team. For us, of course, who had been working with her, for the participants who had been, you know, she had been so close to the other peer specialists. It was very challenging for the other peer specialists to hear that, you know, their colleague passed away and kind of, you know, trying to move on and keep working with the participants. So, you know, we try and dedicate a lot of the work that we do to Kelly because she had such an impact on all of us.
Yeah.
And one of the fondest memories that I have of Kelly work and her charisma and her leadership is when we were training, when the master's trainer from the University of Pittsburgh came and trained our peers, they were challenging the trainers. They were asking questions. Kelly was on top of them, challenging, how will you do this here? How can we change this? How can we make this more appropriate? And at the end of that training, the master training basically hugged Kelly at the end of that training and said, you have challenged me. We've connected. You are passionate about what you're doing. And really, it was touched by the interest and the commitment that Kelly brought to not only doing this intervention, but doing it in a way that really connected with participants to make this real for the people that we were going to be serving in this trial. And she kept that charisma and that motivation throughout the entire time. So it's a big loss for our team, but her memory continues and her dedication to the work is an inspiration for all of us to follow.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I think it's an aspect of the real world that also we need to address and deal with in the context of this work. And I'm sure that sounds like she's greatly appreciated. So my very last question is going to be for you guys both. What is the one takeaway you want for our listeners? You know that we have researchers listening, we have clinicians, we have administrators, we have peers, we have family members. What's the one takeaway?
That's a great question. Yeah, for me, the number one takeaway from this is that some people will benefit from a peer-led healthy lifestyle intervention, that there's a value of having this health intervention delivered by people with lived experiences, who can walk the walk, who can talk the talk, who can connect with people around the struggles of how to change these difficult behaviors, and that peers have a intrinsic value to the delivery of this intervention, and that some group of people will benefit from this work. There's many different types of interventions that we're trying to address the major inequities that have health inequities in people with serious mental illness, and peer-led interventions is one of those interventions that we can continue to benefit from and continue to expand, and that this workforce is really valuable. We want to address these inequities and really eliminate these unfair inequities that are impacting people with serious mental illness.
Yeah, and I think to that, I would just add, I think there's still kind of like this belief out there that individuals who do have serious mental illness and already multiple chronic conditions and so many other challenges that they're not interested in doing this type of thing, that health is sort of not a priority, or that there's a lack of motivation. And I think that if that would be one thing that I would absolutely say was not borne out by this project, where we actually over recruited and had really high attendance, and people were very engaged. So even if there were struggles with sort of making the actual behavior changes, it was absolutely not because, people, we couldn't get people to participate. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is really, having people enter these interventions, but then supporting them to make these changes in their daily lives. That's where the challenge is. And so just encouraging people to make sure that this is really a priority focus area for mm-hmm. this group.
Well, thank you for those two messages. And I hope and I expect that both of you will be working tirelessly to help us figure out who benefits most from what, and so that we can actually provide people with tailored interventions that optimize their own response, because clearly there's never a one size fits all, right? Never. So thank you so much. I'm so grateful for you to have joined this podcast, and we look forward to more papers from this project and your work in the future.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Well, a lot to think about with this intervention and the physical health needs of people with serious mental illness. And it's so great to have accomplished investigators examining this problem. That's it for today. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the article we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. We welcome your feedback. please email us at psjournal@psych.org. I'm Lisa Dixon. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.